You are looking at live pictures from the Noble County Courthouse where Thomas Lee Dillon, it appears, is entering into a plea agreement.
On July 14, 1993, a hearing was held at the tiny courthouse in Noble County, Ohio. Accused serial killer Thomas Dillon was to enter a plea agreement and be sentenced for his crimes. Reporters from all over Ohio and all over the nation were there, including Channel 9 news reporter Lisa Kick.
Just over an hour ago, he handed me that plea agreement. And it basically stated that he would plead guilty to all five. The death sentence, if they went along with this plea agreement, if the judge accepts it, is not an option. The state will recommend that each murder be punished by the sentence of life imprisonment with no possibility for parole.
Thank you.
And it adds up to about 165 full years are served.
The plea was accepted by the court, and Dillon was spared the death penalty. Observers to the hearing noted that he had not seemed particularly upset as the court sentenced him to life in prison.
Lisa, this is Sherry again. I noticed that looking at Thomas Dillon, you've met him in person. To me, I couldn't tell the look on his face of whether that was a smirk or if that's just a natural demeanor, or if it was just basic nerves. Seeing him in person, talking to him in person, what was your opinion of some of the looks that he gave in the courtroom?
Well, Sherry, it seemed as though he was trying to maintain a straight face. He said he was going to have to take this seriously today.
After the hearing was over, Lisa Kick spoke to Dillon's defense attorneys out on the courthouse steps.
This is one of his defense attorneys that have just joined us now. Tom Dillon obviously made a big decision. How do you think he came to it?
I think there were a lot of factors involved. The risk of trial, obviously. The life in death row, which there was a very good chance he would have ended up had we gone to trial, including his ability to talk to his family. Obviously, visitation is very limited on the row.
The plea deal spared Dillon's life. Despite that, up until the moment when Dillon entered his guilty plea before the court, no one had been completely certain that it was actually going to happen.
It seemed as though he was being kind of secretive there towards the end. I know that when you went into this, were you sure he was going to plead guilty to all five of these?
No. It's the one thing about Tom is, you know, I told him that he was, I don't know if you ever saw Little Big Man, but they talk about a contrary, the Indian that would, you know, take a bath by rubbing himself in the dirt and drying off in the water, and that was Tom. You know, if we would tell him he had to do something, you can be sure that he wouldn't do it. I mean, it was, I think we all got a grip on him, and I think he realized all along this is what he had to do. He just didn't want it to be known. That's part of his nature, which I don't understand.
He wanted to create a little drama. Do you think that's Tom Dillon, a man who wants to create some drama?
I think so. I mean, I don't think that's why the killings occurred at all. That's something entirely different. I think that he has controlling nature, that he likes to somehow feel that he's controlling the situation. I think that was his way of doing it.
According to his attorneys, Tom Dillon was a man who used his secrets as a means of controlling others. So did Dillon really give up all his secrets when he finally pled guilty to five murders? Or were there some secrets he continued to hold on to? Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 13 of The State vs. Jeff Titus. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Even before Thomas Dillon confessed his crimes to law enforcement, Dillon had confessed to at least two different reporters, including to Lisa Kick at Channel 9.
Just one day before, in a telephone conversation with me, He admitted he was guilty of all five, that he had killed them all. He said, "I blew them all away."
Defense attorney David Doten noted that Dylan's habit of running to the media every chance he got had complicated matters for both the defense and prosecutors alike.
Were you surprised that he talked openly at least to two media representatives?
Originally, we had told him over and over again, not to, for obvious reasons, but obviously we can't control who he makes us collect phone calls to. We thought we had that under control, and we were very surprised that after the July 2nd statement, which in fact had gone very well, that he called media, and that was very much a surprise.
You might be surprised to know that at 12:15 he handed me a copy of the plea agreement as well as the psychological evaluation. He said, "These are my only copies, Lisa. Make sure I get them back." So
I'm not surprised about that at all. He refers to you as his girlfriend, as a matter of fact. I know you love with that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, once again, we are live. This is what live television does to you. Thank you very much.
Prior to his arrest, Dylan had been known as a loner who kept to himself and had few close friends, just as the FBI profile had predicted. After his arrest, though, Dylan seems to have transformed. The outdoorsman sniper was the hottest news story in Ohio, and this newfound popularity seems to have made Dylan gregarious and chatty, especially with reporters, who often ask Dylan probing questions in an effort to understand why he had done this.
Getting back to this FBI study, I just find this very interesting. There was an interesting fact. Most serial killers who are men, in fact, do kill women. Did he say why his targets were men?
No, he did not say why his targets were men. Sherry, he simply said that he was driven by a compulsion. It was something he couldn't control.
As FBI agent Harry Trombitis remembers, Channel 9 wasn't the only media outlet that Dylan liked to call up.
He enjoyed, I think, the attention. And so anybody that would give him some attention, I think he was, he had a girlfriend that worked for the Akron Beacon Journal, and nice lady. But I mean, he played her, and, in all fairness to her, if you have a chance to have conversations with a serial killer, you're probably going to take a lot of gruff, from that person. And so he liked the attention.
Tom Dylan never expressed any remorse for his crimes, and seemed to feel very little in the way of regret. Once, when the reporter at the Beacon Journal asked him whether killing people had been worth it when it meant spending the rest of his life in prison, Dylan had responded, "In a way, yes, in a way, no." And now that he finally had been caught and his crimes had been revealed, Dylan appeared to delight in how shocked people had been once they'd heard about what he'd done.
They find it hard to believe that someone that looks as normal as me would do something like that. They're fearful of me because, if I said if I had shot my wife, they could understand that, and there wouldn't be any interest in this because that happens all the time. But five strangers, I didn't even know. That's why they're fearful. That could have been them. That's why they just don't understand, and they never will.
This semi-exclusive access to a serial killer that Dylan was offering had been an enticing lure to reporters, but it hadn't come without a cost. The story was in the headline for months, and so reporters continued to take Dylan's calls, even when his prying attention began causing them difficulties in their personal and professional lives. As the reporter from the Akron Beacon Journal described in her series on Thomas Dylan,
"Today was a weird day. An alleged serial killer, with a notoriously twisted sense of humor, professes his affection for me. On the other hand, my husband demands to know what the bleep I can possibly find to talk about for 2 hours with a man who supposedly kills people and animals."
It wasn't just reporters that Dylan called either. He was often on the phone with Agent Trombitis as well. He knew exactly what the Beacon Journal reporter had meant when she described what talking to Dylan was like.
He had a sense of humor, when he talked about stuff.
And for Trombitis, these phone calls were an opportunity to try and negotiate a conclusion to the case he'd been working on since March of 1992.
And we had numerous conversations by phone. He would call me in the FBI office. He would talk to me when we had court hearings and things. I was constantly talking to him about, "Let's get this worked out. Let's get this worked out,"
If Dylan had decided to take his case to trial, he almost certainly would not have been convicted on several of the murder counts that he ended up pleading guilty to. In fact, for two of those murders, Dylan had never even been indicted. There hadn't been any evidence that the prosecutors could take before a grand jury. But as Tom Dylan himself acknowledged in his interview with Lisa Kick, for two of the other murders, the prosecutors did have some pretty solid evidence. They had the murder weapon.
If they wouldn't have had that gun, they wouldn't have a case against me.
You sold it the day of...
The day of April 5th, 1992, when I shot Gary Bradley. 3 hours later, I sold it at a gun show. And the dealer lived 2 miles away from me. I killed Hawkins and Bradley with that gun, the last two victims. My attorney said, how could you be so stupid as to do so? That's the only piece of evidence they had against me.
Without the Swedish Mauser that was used to kill two of the victims, Dylan might have walked free. But with the Swedish Mauser, Dylan was probably getting the death penalty.
He's very willing to face death. He's told me in the past he did not want to face, though, the isolation that you would be given on death row. No phone calls. I believe it's one phone call a year. He does have a 12-year-old son. I do not believe his 12-year-old son was present today. However, his wife was in attendance. She said she wanted to be with him. She has stuck by his side through all of this, through some very descriptive news reports and stories that have come out through the media.
And so, a plea agreement was reached. And before that, in an interview with task force investigators, Dylan gave a 5-hour videotaped confession to law enforcement, though we don't have a copy of it. Every agency we tried to get it from claims their copy was either lost or destroyed. But after his confession to law enforcement, Dylan confessed to the 5 murders once again, this time to Channel 9.
I was out deer hunting in the morning, and I quit about 10:30, bought some beer and just started driving around, ended up in that area, and just there he was. It just happened. I came up over in the ice area and saw him walking on the road, and just I heard a voice in my head said, open fire on him. And I did it. I'd never been down that road before. I didn't know he was going to be there. It just happened.
Dylan's trial had been scheduled for September, and before his confession, many months, it had seemed possible that this case really would go to trial. As Jacinda and Susan explained to Detective Roy Ballett, the plea negotiations with Tom Dylan have been a very drawn-out process.
My understanding is that Dylan, negotiating the plea deal with Dylan was very complicated. He'd go back and forth, he would demand things, he would say yes, he'll take a plea, then he'd say no. And he finally did confess to the 5 killings in Ohio.
But not until they agreed to give him a night with his wife.
Right, he wanted one night with his wife.
They gave it to him.
Good negotiator.
Hey, technically, Dylan didn't get a night alone with his wife. It was a daytime visit. But you get the idea. And Dylan's plea agreement entitled him to other perks as well, as he explained to both the Akron Beacon Journal and to Channel 9.
Dylan said he was very glad he negotiated a plea agreement and get such generous privileges as commissary purchases, telephone use for 3.5 hours nightly, visitation Wednesday through Sunday, and access to television.
Why did you agree to the plea bargain?
It's better all around. They got their 5 cases. I get to go to a place where I can maintain contact with my family. Everybody's happy. Fairly happy.
The only crimes Dylan pled guilty to were 5 homicides that had taken place in southeastern Ohio over a 3-year period, from April of 1989 through April of 1992. But Thomas Dylan had been, in the words of Agent Trombitus, a one-man crime wave. And over the years, he'd committed countless arsons and other vandalisms, causing millions of dollars in property damage. After his plea, investigators from Tuscarawas County had taken him out and driven him around to have him identify which of the other unsolved crimes in the county he'd committed.
Are you saying you burnt 2 buildings here?
Yeah, house and a barn.
You want to tell us how you did it?
The barn had like paper in it. I just went in and threw a match in the paper. It had like cardboard paper. And so I had a blue and white trailer inside of it. And the house back here had a porch. I think it had like trash stored in the porch. I just threw a match in the trash back there. I tried to do that barn there, but I couldn't get in. Look at how it's locked up there. That one's locked up tight.
It says no passing, Tom. Stay out.
There's a house down here on the right I was going to do too, but I never bothered.
One up here on the right?
Yeah.
Dylan also admitted to shooting hundreds of animals, including livestock. Although, when it came to killing cows, Dylan always maintained he was only responsible for the cattle that had been shot with a bow and arrow.
This farmer back here, during all the time these fires were going on, had 8 head of cattle shot at different times.
With guns?
.22 caliber.
Nope. I told you, I never shot a cow with a gun. Never shot a cow with a gun.
But during your confession, you admitted to Shyrock that you shot horses, and so what's the difference?
A horse, because that was at Appaloosa, and he was 100 years old.
That's here with a .22 caliber.
That's different. That's different. I didn't shoot these.
In all, Dylan confessed to 160 different acts of arson. In fact, he'd done so many arsons that he struggled to remember which ones he had done and had not done.
Oh, this is why he suspected me. I had two barn fires at the same time.
Oh, that. Could you be the guy on that one, Tom?
Possible. When was this? March 5th.
Yeah.
During the winter. I wouldn't have been on a motorcycle, though. That's the deal.
Well, you didn't do them all on motorcycles, did you?
No, but 90% of them.
Yeah. That might be that 10%.
During these drives through the countryside, investigators tried to pinpoint which of the crimes Dylan had done by comparing them against things like his work schedule and what vehicle Dylan remembered being in at the time the crime occurred.
Okay, now you're sure you did this barn?
Yeah.
Lee.
That one.
Okay. What color was your truck, man?
Blue.
That was your blue one?
Blue truck.
Positive, because I checked it. That's one of the first. That's one of the first things I checked.
I did this one. Your records are wrong.
Hopper. And your work schedule says you were, yet you didn't.
I know I did that one.
There were other crimes, though, that Dylan denied having any involvement in. And in some cases, those denials seemed pretty credible.
Died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Oh, geez. So why would you suspect me?
Because that's just the way you are.
Jeez. Maybe you went in the house there and found a poor old guy laying in bed and said enough is enough.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. What was he shot with?
Mauser.
not this one.
Although some of Dylan's property crimes may not have been fully resolved, Agent Trombitis believes that Dylan provided investigators with a complete accounting of every crime of violence that he was responsible for.
We certainly couldn't find any other homicides that he was responsible for. One thing you need to know about Dylan was he considered himself to be a very unique individual. Even when he was being interviewed by the psychologist, he kept asking, like, am I one of a kind? And I think if he could have reasonably accepted responsibility for more cases, I think he would have probably done it just to boost up his numbers.
I wonder why he didn't. He could have easily said, yeah, it was me. I killed the two hunters.
Well, because he didn't do it.
If Tom Dylan had committed any further murders beyond the five that he confessed to, then Dylan would have claimed credit for them, Trombitis says. Dylan would have wanted the notoriety that it would bring him. And even aside from concerns about his legacy, Dylan would have had another, more practical motivation for coming clean about what he'd done.
Dylan knew that we were interested in him for the Michigan cases, because I kept bringing it up when I talked to him. And he always denied it. I told him numerous times, Dylan, if we find out that you did something else that you haven't told us about, all bets are off. You understand that, right? And he acknowledged it repeatedly. The attorneys told him that. So, you know, I tend to believe what he's saying as far as the five homicides in Ohio and, you know, unless somebody has some evidence to prove otherwise, I think that's it.
There were no known witnesses to the murders in the Fulton Game area, but there were several witnesses who told detectives Bruce Buscema and Roy Ballett that shortly after the murders occurred, they'd seen something suspicious.
Several people saw and heard the vehicle in the ditch. The neighbors had come down and taken a look at it. So we knew that that had happened shortly after the shots were fired. And if that's not a red flag, I'm not sure what is.
A car speeding south had gone off the road and gotten stuck in a ditch at the southwest corner of the Fulton Game area. The neighbors who got the best look at the ditch car and the man who was driving it were Helen Knopfs and her 9-year-old son, Derek. They lived just up the road from the intersection of Y and 46th Street, where the car had gotten stuck. So they headed down to see if they could offer any assistance.
So I was down in the ditch, and it was like a hatchback type, and there was a the tail light was damaged. It had a duct tape on it.
The car in the ditch was a small, two-door passenger vehicle. It was somewhere between blue and black in color, and had taillights that were flat along its trunk and didn't wrap around the sides. And the man who'd driven the car into the ditch had been acting strangely.
He just seemed like he didn't want to mess with anything here, and he didn't want anybody around, and he was sweating. And I didn't know if he kind of had on camouflage. I didn't know if he'd been hunting, but he just seemed nervous and a little upset, and he didn't want any help.
Helen offered to go back to her house and call the police for help, but the man was adamant that he didn't want her to do that. "Don't call the police," he told her. "I'll figure a way to get out of the ditch myself."
And then about that time, a black truck pulled up to the stop sign, and the guy in the car asked, could he pull him out of the ditch? And he said he could, and so I got in my car and went home.
The next day, Helen learned that there had been two murders at the Fulton game area, and the shootings had likely taken place a few minutes before 5 p.m. That's when Helen remembered the man in the ditch.
So do you remember what time of day it was that this car went in the ditch?
It was about 5 o'clock, I believe. That's why I called the police. I said, you know, I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but the time frame is very, very close.
The detectives had Helen prepare a composite image of the ditch man. He'd been in his 30s, about 5'10", with a sort of sturdy build and a markedly round face. He wore aviator-style glasses.
And they brought a book of cars. They just came to the house, and we sat at the table and went through the book, and I did the drawing.
The car that Helen picked out as being most similar to the ditch car was a 1987 Dodge Shadow, though Helen noted it wasn't a perfect match. So armed with both the composite of ditch man and the description of the ditch car, Detectives Ballett and Worsema did everything they could to try to find the identity of the driver of the ditch car. Or failing that, the identity of the driver of the pickup that had pulled him out of the ditch.
Pickup went one direction, the car went the other direction. We never found either one, even though putting up flyers, advertising on TV, various other things, nobody ever came forth.
You know, there's that whole thing could be unrelated, could be a red herring, for all we know. Just would have been nice to have him present himself and say, hey, you know, I was screwed up, I was drunk or something.
Right, to say, I know you're looking for cool. me.
Yeah, I was scared, I was drunk, you know, something, anything like that.
It was a few years later that the Ohio Task Force got in touch with Kalamazoo and let them know about the suspected serial killer they were tracking.
I think it was at least 2 years, maybe three, that they came up with this gentleman who had been suspected of shooting hunters down in Ohio, and they thought that he seemed to meet the description of the fellow that went in the ditch here. So the detective set up a visit where my husband and my son and I went down to Coshocton, Ohio, and we did a lineup. And I identified a man from the lineup that looked, to my son and I both, a lot like this man, and that we picked him out of a lineup. So that's like it was, like I say, a couple years afterwards that they did that.
Wow, that was sort of an interesting experience to go.
It was quite an interesting experience. It isn't like you see on TV when they do lineups. It's you're peeking through a little hole in a door, and my son had to stand on a chair to be able to see, so.
Yeah. Detective Bruce Worsema attended the lineup in Ohio, as did Detective Terry Van Strain, who in 1992 had been newly assigned to the Fulton game area case. However, there's no report in the case file about the detective's trip to Ohio.
I do remember doing dictation with Terry Van Strain in regard to that case. I can't imagine why it wouldn't be in there. It's gotta be, you know, it was put in, and I remember vividly dictating that stuff, Terry and I. And if there's nothing in the files, like so many other little things that came up out of these files, might have been taken out of the files.
But even in the absence of any reports about the lineup from the Kalamazoo detectives, we know that when Worsema and Van Strain had returned from Ohio, they concluded that Thomas Dillon was not a viable suspect in the Fulton game area murders. And we know that because on February 17, 1993, a few days after the lineup had been done, the Akron Beacon Journal ran an article with the headline, "Dylan Ruled Out. Police Lineup Clears Him in Michigan Slayings."
Take a look at this paragraph here. So this was printed in a paper just a few days after the lineup. Can you read it for us?
Sure. Lieutenant Terry Van Strien of the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department in Michigan said two witnesses did not pick Dylan as the man they saw in the area about the time two hunters were gunned down November 17, 1990 in the Fulton State game area.
After we'd been working on this case for a while and learned for the first time about Thomas Dylan, we started requesting files on him from Ohio. It turned out that the Coshocton County Sheriff's Department, where the lineup procedure had been held, had done their own report on how the lineup was conducted, complete with diagrams that show where everyone in attendance had been standing. There's something decidedly odd, though, about how that report was written.
What's interesting is that Coshocton wrote up a very detailed 3-page report on the lineup, and they sent it to Michigan, Kalamazoo. And their report says, like, both witnesses wrote down a number and made an ID. And then full stop. Doesn't say who they picked out. So the report that Kalamazoo got never said who they picked out in the lineup.
Didn't even give a number?
Nope. It just ends full stop. Both witnesses wrote down their number.
Yeah. So, I don't think I ever saw their report on that. And, you know, I don't remember much about the lineup at all. I know that it took place.
I've never seen or heard of a lineup report that doesn't tell you who the witnesses picked out of the lineup. That is, in fact, the single most important detail that you'd expect a report to include. That might have been the end of our investigation into the lineup, though, given the lack of documentation about it. But Tom Dylan had been convicted of killing 5 men in 5 different counties, which means there were at least 5 different sheriff's departments in Ohio who should have had records about this case. Not all of them did, some seemed to have lost their files, but Tuscarawas County had their files still. And the records we received from them included not only their own reports, but also copies of reports from other agencies in the task force, including a number of reports from the FBI.
One of the interesting things that we found is, here's the top paragraph of this report is sort of the summary of the lineup.
Yeah.
But can you read that top paragraph?
Sure. Says, a fair lineup was conducted in the presence of Dylan's attorney, Roger Sinnenberg. Upon the completion of the lineup, it was learned both witnesses positively identified Dylan as the individual they saw at the vehicle stuck in the ditch.
So it was a positive identification.
They said it looked like the guy that they remembered seeing in the ditch. Absolutely. Yeah.
According to Agent Trombitis' report, both Helen and her son Derek positively identified a serial killer who targeted hunters as the man they'd seen who had driven his car into a ditch while speeding away from the place where two hunters had just been murdered. To me, this feels like something that might have been worth following up on, but no one ever did. All of the investigators from Kalamazoo, including both the original investigators and the cold case team, say that they were never aware of Agent Trombitis' report. And to date, the only agency we've found that has a copy of this report is Tuscarawas County. And it's possible that's the case because, technically, this is not an official report at all, something that I hadn't realized until Agent Trombitis pointed it out.
One thing that I noticed about this document, if you're familiar with FBI documents at all, we have what's called an FD-302, and that's like the report that I gave you with the confession and everything. That's a sort of our sworn statement kind of thing. And, you know, when we put things down on a 302, that's what we're willing to testify to.
An FD-302 is the standard report form used by the FBI to document investigative activities. It's the form that federal agents use for reporting things like what a witness said in an interview, or taking an inventory of items seized in a search, or recording the results of a lineup. I had thought, or rather I just assumed without thinking, that the report in the Coshocton County lineup had been an FD-302. And it did use the exact same format and font as the other FD-302s in the file. But this report was not a 302. It did not have the standard 302 header. It had no header at all, in fact. Just the case number and the agent's initials.
When we do an insert, we call it an investigative insert, where I was just reporting some investigative activity that occurred. So I'm just struggling to try to remember much about it, about the lineup and that. I didn't know if I was told the results of the lineup and that's what I did my insert on, or whether, you know, I firsthand saw, you know, that the identification was made. I just know that two people had picked them out. You know, I can't dispute any of that. It doesn't change anything in my opinion of the case.
An insert is not a standard bureaucratic form. It's really just a piece of paper that's used by FBI agents to record what they have termed non-testimonial investigative activity. That is, investigative activity that the agent would not testify about in court. This lineup took place nearly 30 years ago now, and Agent Trombitis has little memory of it today. Unfortunately, no one else recalls much about it either. For instance, we know from the report from the Coshocton County Sheriff's Department that Tom Dillon's attorney was there for the lineup, but I asked him and he told me he does not recall Dillon ever being a suspect in a case from Michigan, let alone that there had ever been a lineup done with witnesses from that case. And when Jacinda and I told Kalamazoo Detective Roy Ballard about the investigative insert, he was just as shocked as we had been.
I have no words for it. If that is what occurred, it's a classic screw-up as far as I'm concerned, because there's nothing in that I ever saw or heard about in the report. It should have been known somewhere between Ohio and Kalamazoo County Sheriff Department, two people dropped the ball.
Yeah.
That's all I can say is if that's...
Something went wrong.
Scary.
I have no answers about what happened here. I wish I did. But I don't know why no one in Michigan knew about Agent Trombitis' report, and I don't know why Detective Van Strien told the press that Helen and her son had failed to pick Dillon out of the lineup when in fact they had picked him out. And I don't know who at the lineup ever even knew that a positive ID had been made.
The witnesses wrote down numbers, so they didn't say it out loud. They wrote down the number of the person. So there was no verbal...
Which identified Tom Dillon. Then where in hell were these other two idiots, and why didn't they get that same information? That's the first thing I would ask.
As an attorney, like reading this whole situation, all the files on this, the part that stands out to me is that Dillon's attorney, he knows this. He knows the ID is positive. And he immediately says, okay, client, go talk with the FBI agent all by yourself. I'll just be out here joining those guys for a smoke break.
Right.
I cannot imagine my client, after a positive ID for a crime he has not even been charged with yet, your first response is, go talk alone to the FBI guy. Have some fun.
I can't imagine that happening, but it did. In Agent Trombitis' insert about the lineup, there's a second paragraph that describes what happened immediately after the lineup had concluded.
After the lineup was conducted, attorney Roger Sinnenberg approached Agent Trombitis and that his client Thomas Dillon wished to speak with Trombitis alone. Attorney Sinnenberg advised he had no problems with S.A. Trombitis talking with Dillon. S.A. Trombitis met with Dillon for approximately 20 minutes in an interview room at the Coshocton Sheriff's Office.
So you're at the Coshocton lineup. Yeah, the two witnesses ID him, the serial killer, they pick him out, and immediately he says, where's Trombitis? I want to talk to him.
Well, because I was there, he only has a certain amount of, I mean, you know, if I'm there and available, he wants to talk. You know, why he wanted to talk to me in this particular moment, I mean, I don't know. I don't recall anything about, you know, geez, I hope they didn't pick me out kind of thing. You know.
You left him alone. Now, wouldn't you want to be like, so, buddy, what's up with that? They picked you out. You know what that is? Or
no, I don't think I would say anything about the outcome of the, whether we did or didn't pick him out. And it's possible, and again, this probably it doesn't satisfy you. But if they didn't say it out loud and they dismissed the lineup, I might have gone right out as well without knowing whether there was a positive identification or not.
The thing that really confuses me about all of this is that Agent Trombaitis struck me in general as a careful and diligent investigator. And he had no interest in protecting Dylan. I have zero doubts about that. He wanted Dylan to die in prison. That was his mission. So what happened here?
The file from Tuscarawas County has also contained a report from Agent Trombaitis about his private, no attorneys allowed interview with Tom Dylan. And this time, it was reported in an actual FD-302 form. According to that 302, the reason that Dylan had wanted to talk to Trombaitis was to thank him for his good treatment of Dylan during the initial interview after his arrest. Dylan then told Trombaitis about, quote, his boredom at the Lake County Jail and advised he was not able to watch television. Dylan complained about some other things as well. He told Trombaitis that, quote, if Richard Fry was really his friend and wished to help, why didn't he step in earlier and do something to stop him? He wished there would have been somebody that could have stepped in and helped him, but his wife Kathy was too meek of an individual, and his supposed friend Richard Fry never made the attempt. Dylan also told Trombaitis that, quote, he believed it possible for both sides to get together at a later date and work things out, i.e. to reach a plea deal.
Those discussions that we had, it wasn't anything about the lineup or anything like that that I can recall. I don't think he was worried about that at all, to be honest with you.
Dylan's attorneys let an FBI agent speak to their client in private immediately after he'd been identified as the man who'd been fleeing from the scene of a double homicide. But they weren't letting just any member of law enforcement to have access to their client.
His defense attorney is not going to allow, would not allow us to talk to the man.
Why not? Why wouldn't he want him to talk to you?
I don't know. He just would not.
Detective Bruce Wersima had tried to talk to Dylan, but Dylan's attorneys refused. The same thing happened with other suspected cases out of Ohio as well. When the Pennsylvania authorities also requested to speak to Dylan about the murder of a hunter that had occurred in their state in 1984, they got the same answer that Wersima did. Still, Detective Wersima says, even without being able to speak to him, there have been two further reasons that Dylan could be ruled out as a suspect.
But I could not place him up here. And they did place him in Ohio in the afternoon of these murders. The agency in Ohio ran it down, and they identified him as being in a game area in northeast Ohio. And the investigators in Ohio were not able to place him in any vehicle that Mrs. Knopfs had seen.
Ohio told the Kalamazoo investigators that Dylan had an alibi for the murders in Michigan, and that Dylan would not have been in a car like the one that had been driven into the ditch near the Fulton game area. And after hearing that, the Kalamazoo detectives had concluded that Dylan could be ruled out as a suspect in the Fulton game area murders.
And once that game officer put him at the other thing on that day, it was kind of like, well, we got to move on from that.
One of the things Bruce recalls is that he was very interested in Dylan as a possible suspect in the double homicide in the Fulton State game area. But he also remembers Ohio, I don't know who specifically, telling him that Dylan had an alibi that day on November 2nd.
Yeah, I heard something about the deer at 10:30 in the morning or something. I looked at my timeline. I don't have any record of that. So I don't know. I can't. That was news to me.
It was not due to any alibi that Agent Trombaitis had ruled Dylan out as a suspect in the Kalamazoo case. Trombaitis had not been involved in investigating where Dylan was on November 17, 1990. That had been done by Ohio law enforcement agencies, and they had concluded that Dylan had been hunting in Ohio on the day of the Michigan murders. When I first heard about this, though, I'd been skeptical about whether that could be true, because on November 17, 1990... Ohio's deer season hadn't yet opened. It was still 9 days away. So how could there be a record of Dylan hunting in Ohio then? But the files we received from the Sheriff's Department in Noble County gave us the answer. in the days after the lineup in Coshocton County, the Ohio DNR and the Muskegon County Sheriff's Department had obtained records about Dillon from the Ravenna Arsenal, a military complex up near Cleveland that had been used in the Vietnam War to make ammunition. The arsenal is located on a sprawling 21,000-acre facility, with the entire complex fenced up to keep intruders out. But what happens when you have thousands of acres of fenced-in forest? You get deer. Lots of deer. Too many deer. Which is why, every year, the Ravenna Arsenal holds a controlled hunt where a few lucky hunters get to come in for a day and help clear some of the deer population out. Thousands of hunters enter the Ravenna Lottery every year. One of the reasons it's a popular place to hunt is that, back in 1940, one of the most famous white-tailed deer of all time was found there. This deer is known as the hole-in-the-horn buck, and for a white-tailed deer that died 80 years ago, it's pretty famous. Seriously, it's got its own Wikipedia page. When I'd first heard about the hole-in-the-horn buck, I'd been picturing some sort of great prince of the forest, like Bambi style. But when I finally saw a picture of old hole-in-the-horn, I realized I'd been very much mistaken. To me, a non-deer hunter, the hole-in-the-horn buck looks less like a trophy and more like a creature you'd run into in a Fallout game, because something went very wrong with it. But his horns are indeed very large, which is why so many hunters enter the lottery at Ravenna every year. And in 1990, Tom Dillon was one of the lucky few to win a spot for a hunt held at Ravenna on November 17, 1990, the same day as the Fulton Game Area murders. This was the alibi that the Ohio agencies had found for Dillon.
On the day of the scheduled hunt at Ravenna, Tom Dillon would have arrived at the arsenal before sunrise. He would have been checked into the complex, given a quick briefing by arsenal officials, taken out to his assigned patch of forest inside the arsenal grounds, and then left there to hunt. And Dillon's hunt at the arsenal that day went well. At 10:30 that morning, he shot a buck. We know this because in files from Ohio, there's a deer tag that was filled out that day to record his kill. Jacinda and Susan spoke to Detective Ballett after they'd found this record.
We know he tagged the deer at 11:20, so after that, he's free to go where he wants.
11:20.
Is when the deer tagged.
So from 11:20, he could have come anywhere or gone anywhere, and that's
weird.
And we know it's about a 4-hour, 10-minute drive.
To the game area.
To the game area in Fulton.
That's a lot more accessible than Jeff Titus was.
Thomas Dillon had been ruled out as a suspect in the Michigan cases because this deer tag had supposedly provided him with an alibi. But it's not really an alibi. What it shows is that on November 17th, 1990, Dillon shot a buck at 10:30 a.m. And that buck had been tagged at the check station at 11:20 a.m. At that point, Dillon would have been escorted off of the arsenal property and on his way. But the Michigan shootings occurred just minutes before 5 p.m., which means that Dillon would have been left with a window of 5 hours and 30 minutes in which to make a 4-hour and 10-minute drive from Ravenna to the Fulton game area.
I don't know what to say. I'm shocked. I had no idea about that. At least it should have been, at least there should have been more attention paid to it. So if he checked out at 11, that's plenty of time.
It's a bit close, but it's more than enough time.
The drive from Ravenna to Fulton wouldn't have left Dillon much time to spare, but it would have been doable. And this is a case where, at trial, the prosecution's entire theory is that Jeff Titus committed these murders by inexplicably sneaking away from the Shepherd farm and making a speed run out of driving back home, committing the murders and then driving back. Clearly, the prosecutors had no objections to theories that require suspects to make long and convoluted drives to commit murder at the Fulton game area. Because if they did, they'd never have charged Jeff Titus. And there's a reason that Tom Dillon might have wanted to drive across state lines that day. Because in 1990, Ohio had a one-and-done policy when it came to deer hunting. You got one deer, either a buck or a doe, taken at any hunt, and that's all you were permitted to kill. And aside from the special hunt area at Ravenna, it wasn't yet hunting season in Ohio. Hunting season didn't begin until November 26th. But just across the state line in Michigan, it was opening weekend for deer season. The woods of Michigan would have been crawling with deer hunters. And if, after leaving Ravenna, Tom Dillon had wanted to continue deer hunting, or if he had wanted to switch to hunting deer hunters, he would have had to leave Ohio to do so.
Another reason that Agent Trombitis believes that Dillon is not responsible for the Michigan murders is that both victims in that case were killed with shotguns. Dillon, Trombitis says, only killed with rifles, preferably Mausers. But while Dillon did claim in interviews that he would only use certain kinds of weapons for certain kinds of crimes, for instance, he insisted he only ever killed cows with bows and arrows, never a firearm, Dillon never claimed that he wouldn't kill a human with something other than a rifle. And on November 17, 1990, Dillon had been armed with a shotgun, not a rifle, a 12-gauge, same kind of weapon used in the Fulton Game Area murders. Dillon had actually borrowed it from a coworker. He'd asked if he could use it for the controlled hunt at the Ravenna Arsenal.
There was one other interesting Dillon connection. Dillon borrowed a Mossberg from a friend.
He had thousands of, he had access to hundreds of guns.
Yeah, so why did he borrow one?
He wanted to see what it shot like. I mean, that's not unusual. I mean, I've been in situations before. Hey, let me use your gun. I've never used one before. I buy it. Again, I don't know the circumstances to it, but that's not that unusual that you would borrow a gun from somebody in that to go out and, you know, target shoot or hunt or whatever.
Deer hunting.
Well, the weird part was when he returned it, without the barrel. He said he lost the barrel.
Lost the barrel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard this.
The coworker said he borrowed the gun, and he said...
How did this come up? I mean,
a report from the Lincoln Shopping again. And the report says the friend contacts y'all. He's like, just so you know, on the 17th of November... he was borrowing my shotgun to go hunting. He returned
on the 17th of November.
He knew because of the hunting date, because of the Ravenna Arsenal. Because Dillon had won the lottery, so he knew the date of it from that. So he said, Dillon borrowed my shotgun, and they returned it and said, thanks for the shotgun, I killed a deer with it, but I lost the barrel. I'll get you a new one, sorry. And he did get a new barrel eventually. Like, he bought a new one for him. So the friend was like, okay, well, I guess it's repaired. But like,
I don't think I ever heard that.
Yeah,
at least I don't remember it. Yeah, that's weird. That's a weird thing. But that, again, that doesn't prove anything. So.
Actually, on November 17th, 1990, Dillon didn't have just one shotgun. He'd had two shotguns that he'd borrowed from two different coworkers. In advance of the hunt at Ravenna, Dillon had approached both coworkers to ask if he could borrow a shotgun, and both coworkers had agreed to lend him one. It wasn't until after Dillon's arrest for the serial killings that the two coworkers compared notes and realized that Dillon had been borrowing a shotgun from each of them at the exact same time. Which was strange by itself, but what was stranger still was that when Dillon had returned their shotguns, one of them without its barrel, Dillon had told both of them the same thing. Thanks for letting me borrow your shotgun, he said. I used it to kill a buck at Ravenna. This couldn't have been true, of course, not for both of them. Dillon must have been lying to one of his coworkers, because he only could have used one of the shotguns to kill the deer that he'd tagged at Ravenna. The other shotgun, he must have used for something else.
When Tom Dillon died in 2011, he took many of his secrets with him. We will probably never know what he did with that second shotgun, or how exactly he lost the barrel to the first one. He never admitted to law enforcement that he'd committed any crimes on November 17th, 1990.
If Dillon had said he'd done them, what would you have done?
Oh my gosh. If Dillon would have, if Bruce or the detectives weren't there, I mean, that would have been our first phone call. Hey guys, we got your killer. He just admitted to us that he killed get on down here and interview him, I mean, there's families of these, of Mr. Bennett and Mr. Estes. I mean, they deserve answers. I mean, their loved ones were taken away. Oh, my goodness. I would have given them anything to clear these cases up. But it just didn't go that way.
Once Dylan denied to law enforcement that he'd committed any murders beyond the five he pled guilty to, the investigation into his involvement into any other homicides came to an end. Things just didn't go that way. But Tom was a chatty kind of guy, or at least he was after his arrest. And just because Dylan never confessed to law enforcement, that doesn't mean he wasn't talking to someone.
Why'd you talk so openly with me and then confess to me on the phone the day before you told authorities? You
seem like a trustworthy person. I don't know. Why do people do things? I don't know. Like I told you on the phone, it's easier to talk to a stranger than your own relatives or your attorney, you know? It's, you know, like talking to a priest. You can confess to a stranger, but not to a, you know, somebody you've known. I don't know.
Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to episode 13 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. There's no addendum this week, but we're back on Monday with episode 14. Amethyl Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. Music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logis, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Eric Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.